The Bane Free Radio Hour.
On the podcast, Mercurian life at the Terminator discovered, but discovered to be serious manic depressives, too exhausted and disheartened to bother finishing civilization, even though they make a serious start every revolution. Plus, we continue the complete audiobook serialization of Larry Correia's Son of the Black Sword. All right now. Welcome to the Bane Free Radio Hour podcast. It's an honor to have you along. I'm Bane Senior Editor Tony Daniel. This time we continue with part two of an interview with David Weber and Jacob Hollow, and Bane publisher Tony Weisskopf stopping by. We discuss The Gordian Protocol, a new science fiction novel by David Weber and Jacob Hollow. It's got time travel, spaceship battles, weird far futures, and a plot to change history. All of it backed up with intelligent heroes from present, past, and future. It's a really fun book, and David, Jacob, and Tony talk about it here in part two of this interview. And we continue with the complete audiobook serialization of Larry Correia's great high fantasy novel, Son of the Black Sword. Now here's the news. Hey, there's new free fiction and nonfiction at the Bane.com website. We've got new content every month there for you, and often the short stories are set in the world of an upcoming book to give you a taste of it. For example, May's free fiction is Voodoo Magic by Robert Buettner. This one is set in the world of Bob's most excellent new historical techno-thriller, Alternate History Blend, My Enemy's Enemy, which is coming up next month, which is a great book. Last Chance. Aeronautical history expert Cassidy Gooding finds herself on a tiny, all but deserted rocky island at the easternmost tip of the Grand Caymans, searching for the remains of a mysterious downed aircraft of great historical significance. It's the sort of thing she's used to doing. Unfortunately for her, she's also used to billionaire plunderer Parkman Silver scooping her finds. When Silver shows up on Last Chance Key with his golden yacht, it will be a race to preserve a historical artifact few know exists. Also in the main page now at Bane.com is Warships of Sea and Space, Form Follows Function Follows Technology. This is part two of a big old piece by Jim Beale. This is Jim's follow-up to last month's excellent piece, so read them both if you can. They're really good. Flights of Fantasy. Science fiction writers and artists have long imagined futuristic spacecraft, but real-life craft is limited by technology. In this essay, Jim Beale predicts using current tech what the spacecraft of the near future might look like and how we can one day get to the spacecraft depicted in science fiction. Warships of Sea and Space, Form Follows Function Follows Technology, Part 2 by Jim Bell. And I've been calling him Jim Beale, haven't I? But he says it Jim Bell. And short story, Voodoo Magic by Robert Buettner, are both available to read for free at Bane.com. And both will be available long-term in the Bane eBooks collections Free Nonfiction 2019 and Free Stories 2019, which you can find and suck into your e-reader of choice at Bane eBooks there at the Bane.com site. This is part two of a three-part interview with David Weber and Jacob Hollow and Tony Weisskopf talking about Gordian Protocol. Part one is available last week on the podcast, and part three and the finale will be available next week. I want to welcome David Weber and Jacob Hollow to the podcast, and we also have with us Tony Weisskopf, Bane publisher. Hi, everyone.
Hey.
Hello.
Hi.
David Weber is the creator of the internationally best-selling Honor Harrington series, with latest entry, The Most Excellent Uncompromising Honor, now at booksellers everywhere. David has had 29 New York Times bestsellers, and there are over 8 million David Weber books in print. David is also the author of many other Bane books, including the epic fantasy Bazel series, with latest entry book one in the Ken Hodden subseries, Sword of the South. He's the author of The Road to Hell with Joel Presby, along with two other books in the Multiverse series, and out now, we have a very excellent new novel by David Weber and Jacob Hollow. Jacob Hollow is a former Ohioan, former Michigander, living in sunny South Carolina. He describes himself as a writer, gamer, hobbyist, and engineer who started writing after his parents bought him an IBM 286 desktop back in the 80s. He's been writing ever since. Add Booksellers Everywhere Now is The Gordian Protocol by David Weber and Jacob Hollow. This is a new adventure science fiction novel set in a totally new Weber milieu with both spaceships, far future tech, and most of all, mind-bending time travel.
Well, speaking of lovers, let's talk about the people in the other timeline too.
Okay. Benjamin. All right. Okay, I did the first, 10% maybe of the manuscript, and then handed it off to Jacob, because what I was doing in that first 10% was kind of setting a feel for, I did just enough to introduce Raybert and Philo from our agreed notes, and Benjamin Schroeder and who he was, and who Elsbieta, the woman he loves, are. And then I handed off to Jacob, who went away and did all the rest of the original rough draft and did it very well. This book deals with something that is very important to me on a personal level, which is the concept of responsibility. Mm-hmm. I think you can see that in the Honor Harrington books. You can see that in a lot of other books. It deals with the concept of taking a stand and discharging your moral responsibilities. And Benjamin Schroeder's family came to this in an especially traumatic way because his grandfather was a German count growing up in post-World War I Germany. And he initially supported Adolf Hitler. Not Adolf Hitler per se, not Adolf Hitler's anti-Semitism, but Adolf Hitler is a force to regenerate a defeated Germany. And it was Kristallnacht that really brought him face to face with what he had given his allegiance to. When Jews were terrorized all over Germany, businesses were smashed, and the police forces, the forces of order that were supposed to prevent this kind of atrocity, either just stood by or were actively complicit in it. And that meant that he was actively complicit in it as a member of the military.
Now, we should mention that this is actually what happened in our timeline.
Yes, this is what happened in our timeline. And so he had to deal with the consequences of what he had done. And as the war proceeded and as as Kristallnacht was writ large in the Holocaust and everything else, he sent his wife and their son, to the United States before the U.S. entered the war, in part because he kind of suspected he might wind up in some dangerous waters here. He was wounded in the campaign in France. He went into intelligence work. He wound up with Reinhard Gehlen in the Abwehr intelligence group specializing in the Soviet Union. He was involved in the plot to assassinate Hitler. And after the war, he was part of West German intelligence until his retirement. His wife refused to ever return to Germany, where she'd been born, because of the Holocaust, because of what her country had done. And when he retired, he joined her in the United States. But the iron rule that he taught to his kids and that his son taught to his kids was that you cannot compromise your own moral principles, and that you have a responsibility to meet the standards of those principles. And that, as Edmund Burke said, you know, that for evil to triumph, all that is necessary is for good men, as he had done as a young man in Germany, for good men to do nothing. And that is just, it's an absolutely essential component of who Benjamin Schroeder is in our 20th century, and also the Benjamin Schroeder we meet in another 20th century that is radically different. Is that a fair summation of Klaus Wilhelm and his impact?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, just so embedded in the DNA of Benjamin's character and how he was raised as a responsibility taker. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, sort of this omnipresent force, you know, that it was around him and helped mold him as a person, so that, you know.
Yeah. And there's one other side of that I didn't touch on that is also critical, which is that as part of your responsibility to take responsibility, it's your responsibility to actually use your brain. It is your responsibility to not go along with whatever the mood du jour is, to be a critical thinker before you decide where you're going to take your stand. Kind of a little bit of be sure you're right, then go ahead thinking.
There is the center and the heart of the book, which is when Raybert meets Benjamin. And Benjamin is a man of two worlds. He is a cool character, and a lot of the book takes place in basically our present, when they have to learn to deal with each other. The basic problem is that Benjamin has gotten this really cool life at the expense of the world ending for everyone else, and he's got to make a choice, and Raybert's there to present him with that choice, right?
I think it goes a little farther than that.
And tell us a little bit about Elsbieta as well. She's a very important character in the book.
Okay, well, let me just say that Benjamin's choice, to me, is what the entire book was about from the very beginning, conceptually. I wanted to take a highly moral human being who believed in doing the right thing, facing his responsibilities, and present him with the most horrific moral choice that he could be called upon to make. And in this instance, the horrific choice that he has to make is essentially between taking personal responsibility for the Holocaust, for the Cold War, for the Korean War, for, you know, millions upon millions of deaths that didn't happen in Benjamin II's timeline because of the Gordian knot that has to be untied. Untying the knot will return to what Benjamin II remembers because he shares Benjamin I's memories. And there's actually a reason why he does that we go into in the book. But he has to make this choice as to whether or not he's going to assume responsibility for that, for this sort of, you know, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years in the future, not really real yet, moment. The woman that he's fallen in love with, Elsbieta, is a retired naval aviator who was medically retired after being horrifically wounded, leading a successful strike to take out nuclear weapons in South America before war down there escalated. And she won't exist in the universe that would be restored because her grandparents are all in Poland and she's Jewish. And so in addition to responsibility for this Holocaust that he remembers intellectually from another universe, he will be responsible for the non-existence of the woman that he loves, who is a remarkable human being in her own right. And he basically decides, I'm not going to do it.
The Rock.
I can't do it. Yeah.
I mean, she's definitely the Rock that he's been supporting him as he's tried to piece his scrambled head back together.
And
pick up the blasted pieces from his mind. Yeah,
because he's got these two totally sets of memories. It's a psychotic break as far as he can tell. And the fact that he could imagine this other universe with the Holocaust and everything in it horrifies him. Because what does that say about him? She's had to deal with PTSD. She's there for him. She's there when the break occurs. She's what gets him through it sane, or as close to sane as he is. And she's also the Rock that won't let him shirk his moral responsibility however much he wants to. I don't know that we want to go into exactly how that works out.
No.
But that is the central problem of the book, and that's what makes it such a wonderful high stakes sort of story at heart, because it's really about everything that has to do with all of these different people's characters and storylines gets tied up in this incredible moral and existential choice that they got to make, and then they got to fight for it, of course.
On both sides. And I would say also that it never hurts to take a really, really, really good fighter pilot and draft her for your crew if you're going to go up in a dogfight with one TTV against a dozen chronoports. Okay? I mean, you know, having somebody who made ace on her way out from the strike on board is definitely a force multiplier for the good guys.
Well, we should point out, too, that neither of these guys is your traditional military science fiction action hero. The professor is a professor, and Ray Baer is
but he's an academic. They both
he's an academic.
Very academic.
The Doc Savage of academics.
Well, yes. But no, he's not a tall guy. He's, you know,
not at the beginning.
No, but that's true. Raybert gets bigger. You know, that traumatic event he experienced, he grows as a concept.
He grows as a person.
But the point is that these are men of the mind. Okay.
Yes. Raybert does have the advantage that he's downloaded martial arts as part of his basic art training. I mean, he's part of art even while he's opposing it. And Benjamin does have one advantage over a lot of academics, which is that he really likes guns, especially handguns. He spends a lot of time, you know, on the range and whatnot. But, you know, in terms of, oh, yes, I am a trained special forces operator who can kill 17 people with a piece of piano wire. No, neither of these guys is remotely in that category. And this is who we're depending on to save the universe. I mean, you know, we couldn't get Bruce Willis. We had to settle for them, you know.
Well, Schroeder, we may meet Granddad again since this is a time travel story. Schroeder, tell us a little bit about when we meet him. He's an academic who is just on the edge of getting tenure at a small college that he's got a historical connection to. And I just think it's a real nice intro to his character because he's in a mental and sort of spiritual conundrum. And it's not a dire situation where he's about to be killed, but it's something that could end his career.
Hey, well, okay. This one is more on me than on Jacob. Basically, Benjamin's great-grandfather, I guess I'd have to go back and count the generations, was he was an operator on the Underground Railroad before the American Civil War. And following the Civil War, he and some like-minded guys, some Quakers and whatnot, decided that if you were going to actually integrate freed blacks fully into a society, you had to provide the education for them to do that. And it would be a really good idea to, like, I don't know, educate blacks and whites together. And they founded this this small college in North Carolina, and it basically managed to survive in North Carolina despite a few ugly incidents in its early years. And it never really got huge, but it was regarded as almost a historically black college, even though it always emphasized the fact that this is a multiracial student body. That's part of its core purpose for existing.
Yeah, we should say this is a fictional college, but it has roots in several, you know, other historical college that were inclusive.
Absolutely. When the 60s roll around and the civil rights movement takes off, this college is discovered. And it's been this successful model that has operated to provide quality education while advancing this vision all this time. And so its student body begins to grow hugely. It goes from being a four-year, you know, from being a college into becoming an entire university. You know, it expands enormously in a brief period of time. Well, Benjamin's mom is she's an alumnus of the college, and by the time Benjamin comes along, they're sort of succumbing to their success, in the sense that they are getting into some of the intolerance that you see on campuses today of opposing viewpoints. And I'm not going to get down in the weeds here and argue about, you know, Antifa versus Nazis or anything else. I'm just going to say that I believe, and this is part of my sense of responsibility, but my belief is that the function of a college is to teach people to think, and that you don't learn to think if you only think inside your own comfort zone. The greatest compliment I was ever paid when I was teaching at Appalachian State University was the student who came to my office and said, "Can I ask you a question? Do you believe in anything?" And I said, "Excuse me?" And she said, "I have been sitting in your class all semester while you've been teaching us, and I can't decide what you think about anything you're telling us about." And I said, "Thank you," because it wasn't my job to tell them what I thought about it. It was my job to help them to understand what they thought about it. Yep. And that's exactly how Benjamin sees education, and he sees this dying at this university that is so much a part of his maternal family's history. I mean, he comes honestly by this responsibility streak from both sides. So he has joined the history department in part because he thinks that it's his job to try and pull them back some in that direction. And the opening section that Tony is talking about here is actually based on a conversation that I had at a convention when I was on a panel. And we were talking about, you know, history and science fiction and so forth. And I pointed out that women did not achieve the franchise in this country at the point of a gun, nor did African Americans free themselves. That women achieved the franchise because they convinced a sufficient number of males that women damn well should have had the vote all along under the if you look at what the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are really supposed to be about, and that African Americans achieved their freedom because 300,000 white guys killed each other to settle the question. And I was not in any way denigrating women, nor was I denigrating blacks. Harriet Tubman, you know, the
well, and the black troops who fought as well. So
the black troops who fought Douglas. I mean, you know, I was not in any way trying to minimize them.
Yes.
And this person in the audience said, "I can't believe you would say that from the position of the white privileged male patriarchy." And I was like, "Excuse me." And that conversation went for about 5-10 minutes of panel time. I said, "You know, look, we can talk about this later if you want to, but it's not really where the panel is supposed to be." We did talk about it later, and actually, the person who had this conversation with me approached me at the Dead Dog and said, "You know, I've been thinking about what you said," and we had a pretty good conversation at that point. But Benjamin gets hit with this in his class, and when he responds that, you know, "That's not what I said," he gets reported for harassing one of his students, who happens to be transgender. And
you're just pushing all the buttons, David.
Hey, you know, what can I say? Well, you know, this is not, in my view, right wing virtue signaling. To me, this is a demonstration of where the intellectual blinkers have gotten to in our academia, which I think is very unfortunate. Anyway, he gets hauled in front of the head of his department, who doesn't like him. Anybody who has his political views must be a knuckle dragger who is wrong on every issue. And besides that, you've already published more research than I have, and I'm 12 years older than you are, so you're a threat to my position. Plus, you're the great-great-grandson of the founder of the college, so I got to, you know, whip you into line here. And he is informed that basically he has to do gender sensitivity training. And the next time that we see him, he's on the pistol range with his brother, younger brother David, and David's husband Steve, while they are shooting up targets. In as much as there is an allegorical function here, and trust me, the allegorical function in my mind is in many ways, in almost all ways, secondary to actually telling the story. But it's that our own preconceptions blind us to the truth so often. The head of his department isn't really a terrible guy in a lot of ways. And in the alternate universe, he's actually one of Benjamin II's closer friends. But he is making assumptions on evidence, on facts not in evidence, where Benjamin is concerned. If Benjamin disagrees with me on proposition A, then he must also disagree with me on propositions B, C, D, E, and F.
It's a logical fallacy that we see over and over again on both sides in our current discourse. So it's nice to be able to treat with that in fiction.
Yeah. And you know, it's for me, the good guys are always the ones who are willing to listen to what somebody on the other side has to say. And you don't have to compromise your core principles doing that. But I think you do have to remember that the people on both sides are human beings. That means that they're fallible. It also means that they are probably being sincere with you when they say that they want the best outcome for everybody involved. And the devil is the details of how you get there. And I think that's what we tend to forget. And we're so busy hitting each other over the head right now that we're not paying any attention to what's inside the head we're hitting, because we have already assigned a value to everything that's in there. We know what's in there, whether we've ever had a conversation with you about it or not.
Well, this is one of the things I like about this book is human fallibility. So we think we've figured out time travel, but maybe we don't have it exactly right. We think we've figured these things out, but maybe it's not. Maybe this doesn't actually work. And the idea that our heroes are constantly testing these suppositions is, I think, part of what makes the fun of the book.
Well, I think that's a big part of it. I think another part of it is that the villain who is chasing Raybert all the way through the book, and who is absolutely determined to destroy him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is in most ways a good and moral person. Okay, now, Jacob, why don't you, I'm going to let you do this, why don't you explain how I could say that Shigeki is a good and moral person when he has been such a ruthless empire builder? Talk a little bit about that difference between the two 30th centuries and why the way that Shigeki has structured his agency and what he does with it is necessary.
Well, I mean, one of the things that Shigeki does is that, I mean, Raybert is guilty of just these monstrous crimes, just for the sake of certain things that, you know, he has technology he's using because...
Just by existing, yes.
Yeah, just by existing. So there's... You know, if Shigeki wants him gone, and gone permanently,
okay,
he has...
Jacob?
Yeah?
Why are these things that he has? What is it? What's the difference between the 30th century and admin that makes Raybert's very existence a threat to... Not the... By the way, we have to fix this problem. I'm talking about the DNA of the two societies.
Before we get to that, let's just say momentarily, let's talk a moment about the plot. I don't think it's going to be any much of a spoiler to say, bang, Benjamin Schroeder's life completely changes. He's not a professor looking for tenure now. He has he's in a completely different universe, but he remembers the old. And this has led to a big problem in the future, because there are two different futures now, and the bad guy is from a future that's not the same future as Raybert.
Well...
Or maybe not. Anyway, it's not just two different futures. It's a knot.
I prefer the term antagonist to bad guy.
Even though he does treat him rather badly in a permanent sort of sense.
Well, no, but I have to say that Shigeki, part of the problem Shigeki has here is that he treated Raybert too gently when he discovered what Raybert was, quote, guilty of, close quote, simply by existing. All right. Essentially, what we have here is that there has been the guys from Raybert's 30th century, and the guys from Shigeki's 30th century, both Siskov and Admin, have demonstrated to their own satisfaction that they cannot change the past. So you can't, for example, as Shigeki, who is the head of a security agency for Admin, you can't go back and arrest, you can't be Tom Cruise, go back and arrest him before he commits the crime. Because, yeah, you could arrest him, you could bring him up to the future, but... it's going to reset as soon as you left. He's going to go ahead and commit the crime anyway. You can't prevent something that predates the edge of existence from happening. Okay? You can go back and you can do intelligence gathering, which is what Shigeki does. You can follow this guy back, find his associates, find them in the present, et cetera, which is precisely what he does. But you can't change the past. Both sides know this. Well, unfortunately, it turns out they were wrong. I can't imagine how that could possibly happen in a David Weber novel. And the past gets pretty cataclysmically trained, creating the Gordian knot that is where the title of the book comes from. And Rayburk doesn't know how the past has changed. He just knows that prior that you know, despite all the theory that says you can't, that it has changed, and that he has to figure out what's happening because it's created this weakness in the multiverse. And he didn't know it was a multiverse until he found this. He thought it was all just, you know, like one universe, and it's not.
Right.
And it's created a situation in which 16 universes have become entangled. There's, for want of a better term, there's a breach in the wall, and energy is pouring through it into one of the universes. And it is moving towards the edge of existence at it's like a time storm, a cyclone howling up the timeline. When it reaches the edge of existence, basically 16 universes will experience the Big Bang all over again. So it's a death sentence for 16 universes if it isn't untangled. And it's about, what, Jacob, 3,000 years in the future of the edge of existence, I think we postulated that this happens. Is that about right?
You know, we actually changed that number, and I forget which number we ended up with, actually.
I think I was originally going to be 5,000, and I think we pulled it back to 3,000 because you were looking at how you had calculated the rate of the time storm's progression, and it, you know, there was this misplaced decimal point or something, and it was actually 3,000. Anyway, the point is that Rayburk sees this as a catastrophe which has to be prevented at all costs. So when he returns to the 30th century, he returns to the 30th century in a universe that isn't his. And he promptly does what a good academic nerd would do. He goes to the authorities to report the problem. And the authorities say, wait, you want to fix it so that our universe never existed so that 15 others will be fine? And this is not going to happen for another 3,000 years? Okay, I'm sorry. I don't think I'm really interested in phasing all of my friends, neighbors, children, and loved ones out of existence. I can't imagine how Rayburk, you know, could have possibly anticipated that anyone might react in that parochial, self-centered fashion. and Shigeki is the guy that he reports it to.
That's why he's doing all these illegal things, because in this future, the things that Rayburk has are things like nanotechnology, for instance, and self-aware beings and such. These are it's called the Yan Lua protocol or something like that, right? It's a
I told Jacob that we needed a defining sort of technological near miss for both societies to define how they went where they got to. I especially liked the one that he came up with for Siskov. It was awful, but it was also funny. It was by the way nanotech,
turning a whole chunk of China into pinballs.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it was bad. Yeah. And in Admin, the problem was basically Skynet. In a way, it was a Chinese military AI that broke out of the box and started following the only imperatives that it had. And there's a reason that the language that Rayburk speaks has a lot of Chinese in it, and the language that Shigeki speaks doesn't. And the reason is that in order to fight to save the rest of the human race, the rest of the world basically had to saturation bomb China to take out the AI that had gotten loose. And so both of these societies have these traumatic technological experiences in their past, and they react to them differently. Okay. And it colors who they are. Admin really and truly, in a lot of ways, is the brutalized child who grows up with a defensive mindset. Okay. and Siskov, where terrible as the near miss was, it did a whole lot less damage. Okay, more embraces technology, but with the understanding that you have to keep an eye on the genie. Okay, but does that seem like a fair way to put it, Jacob?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the admin's attitude as they're kind of figuring out, you know, what Rivert has and where he comes from is like, wow, this must be a society that prances through the rain thinking they won't get wet. It's like, what are these idiots doing? They're playing with all this dangerous stuff so casually. How have they not blown themselves up yet?
Yeah, and it's coming sometime soon, and this is who we should listen to about what we're going to do with our universe. That's definitely part of it. Another part of it is that Rabert's 30th century is a genuine post-scarcity economy. I mean, it really is. They've accomplished that. Okay, admin is still moving through the adjustment period. And the Jacob and I discussed in detail what this transition was going to be like, in our opinion, what the psychological, sociological impacts were going to be. But we discussed it so that we could incorporate it into the DNA of the two societies, not so that we could actually, you know, go through it in the book. But it kind of colors a lot of what's going on in the admin universe right now. Also, the admin universe is more authoritarian, probably isn't the right word, but the admin basically was imposed by force on the entire human race as a how do we keep ourselves alive kind of thing.
It's pretty totalitarian, David.
Yeah.
I would not want to live in that society. It's pretty evil.
You are incorrect.
Oh, okay, all right.
There's a lot going on there. Okay, remember that Shigeki is doing an end run around the elected head of state for admin because he's afraid that this guy might listen to Rabert and decide that that 16 universes outweigh one universe.
But there's these.
That was part two of a three-part podcast featuring David Weber and Jacob Hollow and Tony Weisskopf talking about Gordian Protocol. Part one is available last week, and part three and the finale will be available next week. Now we continue with the complete audiobook serialization of Son of the Black Sword by Larry Correa, book one in the saga of the Forgotten Warrior. After the War of the Gods, the demons were cast out and fell to the world. Mankind was nearly eradicated by the seemingly unstoppable beasts. Until the gods sent the great hero Ram Rowan to save them, he united the tribes, gave them magic, and drove the demons into the sea. But as centuries passed, the descendants of the great hero grew in number and power. They became tyrannical and cruel, and their religion nothing but an excuse for greed. The people rose up, and the surviving royalty and their priests were made casteless, condemned to live as untouchables. The age of law had begun. Ashok Vidal has been chosen by a powerful ancient weapon to be its bearer. He is a protector, a member of an ancient military order of roving law enforcers. No one is more merciless in rooting out those who secretly practice the old ways as Ashok, but Ashok isn't who he thinks he is. And when he finds himself on the wrong side of the law, the consequences lead to rebellion, war, and perhaps transformation. Now here is the latest entry in Larry Correa's Son of the Black Sword.
Chapter 26. Ashok has escaped then. So how many warriors did he kill along the way?
None, Inquisitor.
Ormond took the pipe from his mouth. None? He'd been expecting reports of great slaughter. In fact, he required slaughter, not discretion. If he'd wanted discretion, he certainly wouldn't have picked black-hearted Ashok to be his villain. Really? Not one? I suppose he kicked a dog, but that was about it. They had him surrounded, cut off on both sides of Sutpo Bridge, but rather than fight his way through, he leapt into the water. Sikasso reported. He swam? It appears that way. The wizard answered. He didn't sound nearly as incredulous as Armand, but since the magical assassins of the Lost House routinely engaged in all matter of blasphemous behavior, swimming probably wasn't that remarkable to them. Our fallen protector is full of surprises. The only time I like surprises are parties thrown in my honor or wrapped gifts. Does this strike you as a gift, Sikasso? It does not, Grand Inquisitor. They had the top of the tower to themselves. His men had secured the floors around his guest quarters and swept them for spies, magic, and secret passages. Everyone not part of the Inquisition had been sent away, granting Armand some measure of privacy. However, at the base of the tower, the number of Vadal warriors posted as guards had recently doubled, suggesting his hosts had found the body of the murdered Arbiter. His hosts most certainly knew about the rampage through the prison, but they'd not mentioned it to him yet. They were playing it carefully. When they could no longer hide the news, there would be lots of bowing and apologizing, and the Inquisition would be showered with obligations and concessions to make up for it. Armand was looking forward to that part. As soon as he was officially notified of the escape, he had a very special favor to ask of House Vadal. We've not found his body or his sword, but my men are searching the river bottom now. An easy enough task when you can transform into a fish, I suppose. Sikasso tilted his head to the side. You speak as if you've never used the black steel yourself, but I can smell it on you, Grand Inquisitor. You're a far greater wizard than you let on. Armand waved one hand dismissively. I am nothing. He'd not been the most successful witch hunter in the history of the Order as a result of cunning alone, but he liked keeping his true capabilities secret. It was good to keep his opponents guessing. Of course. Not even Sikasso was bold enough to push that topic. My apologies for prying. This is most curious. Armand returned the pipe to the stand. Vadal tobacco was truly the finest there was, far better than the bug-infested garbage that he'd grown up with, and he would have enjoyed finishing it, but he had work to do, letters to write, and hosts to manipulate. He didn't bother to put his ceremonial mask back on. Sikasso had seen his true face many times already. So, when you say he's escaped, you mean Ashok is truly missing, as opposed to one of your men being so eager to lay his greedy hands on an ancestor blade that he saw his opportunity and murdered Ashok during the fight? That is the risk you take when you hire us. But no. Sikasso was still wearing his stolen protector armor. It was so spattered with dried blood and caked with mud that the silver no longer gleamed. The wizard was civilized enough to remain standing and not soil the fine silk pillows with his filth. You have my word. My men are scouring the countryside and watching every possible path. We will find him. And then you will watch him. I know it pains you, sir, but he's still more valuable alive than dead for now. Armand could see the greed in Sikasso's eyes. He was a collector of magic, and Ashok was walking around with a treasure trove of it. Despite all his talent, all that power and cunning, Sikasso was just as easily manipulated as any other man. As long as Armand could supply him with what he wanted, he would remain a dog on a leash. Don't worry, Sikasso. You'll have that sword in time. This is Ashok we're talking about. If he's alive, just follow the inevitable trail of corpses. If he's dead, then you'll find the sword somewhere. If the warriors do manage to kill him, make sure his body and the witnesses disappear, and I'll simply pay you to create chaos in his name from then on. That would be far simpler. I'm the Grand Inquisitor. I didn't earn the title by being simple. Your plans are beyond my meager imagination, my lord. On the contrary, I believe you have a far better grasp of politics than you let on. That dig was payback for the assumption about Aman's magical abilities. The assassin's house had managed to survive undetected in a lawless no-man's land for generations, so Sikasa was extremely astute. I assume that when Ashok failed to provide a convincing enough display of savage, castless rebellion, you did it for him. We killed most of the warriors there and put the village to the torch. I had the local arbiter's head stuck on the tallest pole. One of my men wrote, "The castless will rise in his blood across the bridge." A nice touch. The survivors don't know what hit them, but they believe it was the Black Heart and a few protectors. Soon, everyone will tremble at the mention of Ashok. Dead or alive, his legend will grow. See? You get it. You would make a fine judge. Sikasa smiled. My job is more honorable. True. Simply killing people was far easier than manipulating people into killing each other for you. Amand was excellent at both. Tomorrow, I begin my journey back to the capital. Castless rebellion and renegade protectors. I imagine someone of strong moral character will need to keep order during this time of turmoil. We'll continue our search. I'll contact you when I have news. Sikasa gave the Grand Inquisitor a small bow, walked to the tower's open window, stepped through, and dropped silently from sight. Amand had to admit that no matter how many times he worked with the twisted men of the Lost House, that manner of exit always remained unnerving. Amand did in fact have incredibly powerful magic, but shapeshifting had never been among his many skills. He liked his body, aging and flabby as it was, to stay in one piece. There was a polite knock on the door. Amand put his mask back on. A moment later, the Inquisitor Taraba entered. "Good evening, sir." He took note of the open window and the billowing curtains. "You've received word from the assassin?" "I did. Things are proceeding well." He could tell his subordinate had something else to say. "You may speak freely. I can tell that he's gone. I just spoke with one of our spies among the Videl. Did the assassin tell you that one of his men died at the prison? His head was stomped into paste, so there's no danger of him being identified, but he was also disguised as a protector." "Our dear friend neglected to mention that." Amand chuckled. That had to sting. There weren't very many members of Sikasso's Lost House. Losing even one would be frustrating. "I don't trust the assassin." "That's perceptive of you, Taraba. I fully expect Sikasa to betray us at some point. That's the nature of such men." "Then why?" He held up one hand to stop his subordinate. The Grand Inquisitor wasn't in the habit of explaining his actions to anyone, but Taraba was a young, extremely capable, and most importantly, loyal Inquisitor. Though he lacked the imagination to ever rise to Aman's position, Taraba was valuable and deserving of mentoring. "Sikasso's kind are addicted to the accumulation of magic. I've employed them to shadow a man carrying around some of the strongest and rarest magic in all of Locke. Normally, such an item would be considered off-limits because they couldn't afford to anger a great house or an order and still survive. But Ashok is dishonored and disowned. There's no one to avenge him. I've planted the idea that even if Ashok dies, Our mutually beneficial arrangement may continue. Being an intelligent man, he will think it through to the logical conclusion. This is a rare opportunity for Sakasa. Eventually, greed will overcome sense. He'll murder Ashok and take his sword. It would surprise me if he wasn't plotting such a move already. Why use them, then? Because the services of the assassin's house are very expensive. They require payment in black steel or demon parts. I'm only paying them to follow, observe, and facilitate. It would be far costlier to hire them to assassinate a bearer, and this way, when they do inevitably dispatch Ashok, their greed will force them to hide it from me. They will lie to my face, and I will gladly continue to pay them for it. Taraba was far smarter than he looked. He grasped the implications right away. They'll keep committing atrocities to blame on the Black Heart. You don't care who causes them, as long as the great houses fear a castless rebellion. Correct. Their unreliability makes them reliable. Plus, it saves us the expense of having to dispose of the extremely dangerous Ashok ourselves, once he's outlived his usefulness. The Inquisition has a budget to keep. That's brilliant, sir. I do my best, Oman said with false humility. Tomorrow was the beginning of another long journey, and he needed his rest. Take this letter with you. As soon as our hosts see fit to inform us about the horrible embarrassment of losing the prisoner, have their wizards will this to their fellows in the capital. Taraba took the letter. Speaking of costly, instantly sending a message such a distance will use up whole fragments worth of magic. Time is of the essence, lad. Our order must know that there are other protectors in league with the rebels. All of the protectors are now suspect, and action must be taken. House Fadal will be so ashamed, they'll be glad to do this favor for the Inquisition, and what's a bit of black steel compared to that? Tomorrow we'll be busy, so I believe I'll retire for the evening. Leave me. His subordinate immediately turned away, but on second thought, there were so many exciting things happening that Armand found himself in a festive mood. Taraba, wait. Have our host send up a pleasure slave for my amusement. Yes, sir. And make sure the girl is someone that won't be missed. The young Inquisitor swallowed hard. It was one thing to torture people as part of your obligation, but another to do it for amusement on your own time. The Grand Inquisitor knew he had a reputation for having peculiar appetites. Of course, sir. Taraba bowed, then fled the tower. Armand rose from the cushions, walked over, and closed the window. The night was chilly.
That was another entry in the complete audiobook serialization of Son of the Black Sword by Larry Correa. And that's it for the podcast. Thanks to Audible.com. Thanks to Bane publisher Tony Weisskopf for stopping by. And the podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz. And a giant espresso and asteroid mocha with foamy comet froth and some Cherenkov radiation sprinkles. Plus a dollop of thanks, praise, and plaudits to David Weber and Jacob Hollow, authors of The Gordian Protocol. Please join us next time here at the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.